as you can see from Michelangelo, the first instruction that our progenitors were given were this cru urvu, which is from the context Adam could understand that it's something that had to do with the way to differentiate from birds and reptiles. But the crucial instruction was in a language that he could not understand. And so he had to use the good office of Eve to haggle with the creator and try to get a translation. And the translation, the way Eve understood, is granulate and multiply. It is in the book of Genesis, not the one that Jim Bauer wrote, but the other one. So granulate and multiply, this seemed to be the crucial thing to do to differentiate from the birds and the reptiles. Granulate and multiply. What does it mean? So it could be that the creator had something completely different in mind, but to Adam and Eve, who were intellectuals, it meant that they had to do something on their minds, on the organ of their minds. And we don't know what their brains looked like, but we have something that is probably similar, which is the mind of a modern crocodile, in which you can see there is a bit of cortex and then a large mass of tissue beneath the cortex. This is one hemisphere, one part of the forebrain, in which the other hemisphere is on the other side, in which there is this bit of cortex, which is essentially just one layer of pyramidal cells oriented orthogonally to the cortical sheath. This large bulk of tissue is something that is probably particular to the crocodile, and you should not think of that as being present in Adam and Eve. But this bit of tissue is probably very similar to what Adam and Eve had. And the way they understood the instruction of granulate and multiply. What? Yeah. I think so, yes. Yes.
What's that white space?
I don't know what... I'm not sure, because I had two images now. I'm not completely sure that this is a crocodile, but if not a crocodile, is a similar reptile, maybe smaller. I'll check that. Anyway, even if it is another species, the organization of the tissue is the same as in the crocodile. So granulate, they took it to me to insert granule cell layers in the cortex, and they did it in more than one place. So first, we'll see that in a kind of cartoon, in which I've drawn a bit of what would have been the cortex of the early mammalian or the reptile, as a knee, in which this bit represents the dorsal cortex and this bit represents the medial cortex. And this cortex is sprinkled with these pyramidal cells that are oriented all orthogonally to the cortex, and they receive their main afferent projections running tangentially to the cortex, with some gradient maybe, but essentially covering large portions of the cortical tissue. Now, the instruction to granulate was applied separately to this bit of medial cortex and to this bit of dorsal cortex. So first, let's look at the medial wall, which in the evolution is at the transition from reptiles to mammals, develop a bend here, the hippocampal fissure, which deepens, as you can see, and the cells that are below the bend, that are more medial, they do not differentiate into full-blown pyramidal cells. They remain a bit like granule cells. Whereas those that are above the fissure, they're regular pyramidal cells. Till eventually, this fissure brings about the full separation of this tissue below. The most medial tissue becomes the dentate gyrus, or fascia dentata, of the mammalian hippocampus. And the part of tissue that was previously connected with the most medial portion, with the fascia dentata, is the cornum monis, is the CA region of the hippocampus, and then here is the subiculum and parietal cortex, and so on. And you can see that the connections that originally were all running tangentially now have to cross this continuity, this solution of continuity, to go and innervate the fascia dentata, and then they, from the fascia dentata, they go on, they continue and innervate the apical dendrites of the pyramidal cells in cornum monis. But there is now a kind of new set of connections, which are the output projections of these granule cells in the fascia dentata, that in the reptilian medial cortex, were the main efferents from the medial wall. Now they just project to the proximal portion of the dendrites of these pyramidal cells in cornum monis. So instead of being efferent projections that from the medial wall they lead somewhere else, in the mammals these projections have become intrinsic, essentially. They stay local, they just innervate these nearby pyramidal cells. So this is a kind of a qualitative step, qualitative change in the circuitry that this originally more or less homogeneous piece of archicortex has become something in which there is a distinction between a fascia dentata and the pyramidal cell populated tissue, and the fascia dentata principal neurons, so to speak, the granule cells. There are also lots of interneurons that we don't care about, but the principal neurons are not really projection neurons anymore. They've become intrinsic excitatory neurons, interneurons, that only project to the pyramidal cells of this cornum monis. Not only that, but they project only to the first half of the cornum monis, which is called in the hippocampal nomenclature CA3, whereas the more distal half, this part here, which is called CA1, is distinct from CA3 in several ways. The main one is that it does not receive the projections from the granule cells. So the first meaning of the instruction to granulate, at least as interpreted by the early mammals, was to insert this granule cell layer just at the front end of this hippocampal circuit. At the front end, because the connections that reach the hippocampus from the rest of the cortex reach first the granule cells and then the pyramidal cells. Although they also reach directly the pyramidal cells, but there are projections from the granule cells to the pyramidal cells and not vice versa, essentially. So 10 years ago with Edmund Rawls, he gave me this problem of trying to understand this circuitry that had to be related to the function of the hippocampus, and people have been thinking about the structure-function relationships in the hippocampus for many, many years, and the, by far the most influential person in this field was David Marr, who was, when he was very young, 25 or so, published a set of three papers on the cerebellum, cortex and neocortex and hippocampus that were really the boldest attempts ever to relate structure to function in cortical circuits. The one about the hippocampus is the most influential, and he built on the theory that several people had developed of the hippocampus as an intermediate term store for a certain class of memories. He mentioned this possibility that a crucial role might be played by these recurrent collateral connections in the CA3 field of the hippocampus. One other difference between CA3 and CA1 is that CA3 is very dense with recurrent collaterals. Indirectly, it is estimated that each pyramidal cell in CA3 receives of the order of 12,000 recurrent collateral connections and only 4,000 or so afferent connections. Whereas CA1 is very sparse with recurrent collateral, since it essentially can be taken to be a feed-forward system, receiving from CA3, but not innervated by collaterals from other CA1 cells. So this idea of Marr that was then taken up by Richard Morris and Bruce McNaughton, by Edmund Rawls and others, was that CA3 is really the engine of the hippocampal system, in which new memories are stored on the synapses of these recurrent collaterals. But then if this is the case, then one has to explain why CA3 cells receive two different afferent inputs, the perforant path that comes from the cortex, and these mossy fibers that are these new sets of projections that come from the granule cells in the fascia dentata, that essentially must convey the same information, because the granule cells themselves, they only receive from the same perforant path. It must be the same information. There is essentially no way in which the granule cells can add something of their own that is not known to the inputs that come from the perforant path. So it's a recoding of the same information. Why does CA3 needs these two different inputs that tell it the same thing in two different ways? And in the dental gyrus, there is a kind of complicated web of, if you might want to call them, recurrent connections with the interneurons of the dental gyrus, of this hilus, this portion here, where there are several different populations of interneurons, both excitatory and inhibitory, but all of which are numerically very sparse. So like in the rat, there are hundreds of thousands of granule cells, and at most tens or fewer thousands of this population of interneurons. So what people say is that these interneurons have a role in regulating the activity of the dental gyrus cells overall, but they do not convey information.
And other than that, there are no connections?
Essentially, no. There are the system is all tightly regulated by neuromodulators that come to different places.
This logic, you say, it needs to go through the gyrus. You can ask this in any feedforward network with hidden units. You can see hidden units don't transmit the same information, but still it can be very useful.
It would be. Yeah, that's precisely what we want to understand. Why is it useful to have both? You see, the kind of puzzle is here is that there is both the perforant path, the direct connections that reaches CA3, and the indirect one. Mm-hmm. Why do you need both? And the puzzle is made more interesting by the fact that these two direct and indirect projections are very different qualitatively. So each CA3 cell in the rat receives, as I told you, 12,000 recurrent connections, about 3,000, 4,000 of perforant path projections, and only about 50 of these mossy fibers that come from the granule cell. So 50 versus 3,600. It's a very different numbers. And the synapses are very different. The mossy synapses are large synapses that are also very potent in firing CA3 cells, to the point that it's estimated that a few, maybe 5 or 10 active MOSC synapses can fire a CA3 cell from rest, whereas it would take hundreds of recurrent or perforant path synapses. So one wonders why there is this distinct, which is clearly a new qualitative invention of the mammals, that reptiles and birds that have a medial wall that subserves more or less the same or similar memory functions as the hippocampus in mammals, but they don't have this new circuitry. Yeah.
I thought Adam and Eve were fully formed humans. They weren't. They started,
sorry?
I thought Adam and Eve were completely developed. They started.
You are implying that I am heretic.
No. Oh, started snakes. Okay. No.
They were designed as snakes. What? They had a design as snakes.
So anyway, the
theology I just didn't know.
The argument that that we developed back then was that, in fact, there is a need for different input systems in the two phases that you can distinguish in the operation of the CA3 network. There is a phase of storing new memory and a phase of retrieving memories that have already been stored. Now, for the second thing, when you retrieve a memory, the idea is that CA3 retrieves from a partial queue, and you can easily convince yourself that to relay the cue that initiates the retrieval in CA3, you need a system with many synapses that also have to be associatively modifiable with something like a Hebb rule, associative plasticity on these synapses. And so the perforant path system seems to be ideally suited to relay this cue in the retrieval phase. But the core argument is that of our paper is that you need something, a very different input system when you want to store new information. And then the main concern is that you want the CA3 system not to be dominated in its dynamics by the recurrent collaterals that encode information which has already been stored and which, from the point of view of the new information, is noise, is interfering information. So there is a kind of old-fashioned solution to this conflict between the old information and the new information. And the old-fashioned solution is to sprinkle the system with acetylcholine, which is a neuromodulator that essentially enhances plasticity while depressing transmission at recurrent synapses. Its effects are very complicated, but they can be simplified in this kind of a summary, that the transmission along the recurrent collaterals is depressed while the plasticity of the recurrent collateral is enhanced. And Mike Asselmo has emphasized this point a lot. So there is this acetylcholine hypothesis that acetylcholine essentially is sprinkled at the time of storing new memories, and this enables or facilitates the encoding of new information without much interference from the existing information. This is...
How strong is the evidence for that? How strong is the evidence?
It's the papers by Mike are not very convincing, but I think overall the story makes sense more than his arguments. And the point I want to make here is not so much to convince you of that story, it's just to say that it's a solution that probably works, that works also in birds and reptiles, and that mammals here wanted to do something better. And what they did better was to provide this new input system, whose effects are essentially similar to acetylcholine, but in a more sophisticated way. So the firing of the granule cells enables to produce that what our argument was, enables to produce a sparse firing in CA3, which is dominated by the new information that has been conveyed by this firing in the dental gyrus, and is not affected too much by the old information, by the circulation of activity on the recurrent collaterals. And we had a kind of quantitative argument based on information measures that I don't want to go about. The point I want to make is that for many years it was unclear whether this the experimental predictions arising from this argument would ever be tested, because people tried with an experiment in which with a drug colchicine, they would destroy the cells in the dental gyrus with a drug that is fairly selective for attacking only the dental gyrus cells. And the idea was that you would see an effect on the in an impairment in learning new memories, but not in retrieving memories that had already been stored in the hippocampus. But this experiment never gave kind of clear results. And then last year, there was this group in France that did a much more elegant experiment in mice, not in rats, in which they used a zinc chelator, using the fact that the mossy synapses are very rich in zinc, already in reptiles. And with the zinc chelator, you can block selectively transmission along this, any synapse that contains zinc. In particular, these mossy synapses in the hippocampus are the ones that contain zinc, without disrupting essentially the functioning of the rest of the system. And they did an experiment in which they had control mice with no substance injected. They had mice with injected this DDC, which is this zinc chelator, and they had another group of mice with injected another zinc chelator that does not permeate the membrane at the synapses, so does not block transmission the synapses, but serves as a overall control for the effect of a zinc chelator in the brain.
What is shown on the y-axis?
Sorry?
What's shown on the y-axis?
So the y-axis is some index of spatial learning based on the Maurice Watermaze task, in which the index, I don't know, is the difference between the time spent in the quadrant where the platform was and the time spent in the other quadrant. So you can see that these three groups of mice, the control and the non-permeating chelator group, they learn to some normal level, whereas those injected with the chelator that blocks transmission on the mossy synapses, they do not learn. But then the crucial thing is this experiment done the next week, where they switch the injections of the two chelators in the two groups of mice. So those that had the blocking chelator DDC now are injected with the EDTA, and you can see that now they learn normally. So they could not learn before, now they learn. And the more interesting thing is those that could learn before, now when they're injected with the chelator that blocks learning, now they still perform well. So it means that they can retrieve the spatial memory that they had learned the previous week. So indeed, blocking transmission at these mossy synapses blocks the learning of, or impairs the learning of new memories of the hippocampal dependent type, but does not impair the usage of memories that had already been stored. So that's not a proof, of course, but it's nicely consistent with this argument on why one had to develop this new circuitry, this new granule cell stage before the hippocampus. And it was a kind of encouragement to understand these granulate and multiply instructions better. But first I want to make the point that in the hippocampus, we mammals granulated it, but we didn't work very much at multiplying, so that essentially, if you compare an opossum, a very simple kind of marsupial, a very unadvanced mammal with humans, you see that this is not to scale. So the hippocampus grows a little bit in absolute size, but relative to the rest of the forebrain, it shrinks enormously. So there is really no multiplication of hippocampal tissue. There is just the granulation. So we did carry out one of the two instructions, but not both, as for the hippocampus. But then the granulate, we did not granulate only this medial this medial wall of the archicortex. Let's look at what happens to the dorsal wall of the reptilian cortex. So one thing that that happens to the dorsal wall is that it acquires fine topography. In reptiles, there is a degree of topography which is given essentially by the gradient of these afferent connections that run tangentially. But in mammals, there is this new trick that now the afferents arrive vertically from the core nuclei of the thalamus that are responsible for each sensory modality. And it is this, again, this qualitative change in the circuitry that allows mammals to have the fine topography, whereby neurons in the sensory cortex have what we know as receptive fields that in reptiles are essentially not there, are very, very vague and diffuse. So there is this this qualitative change in the way the afferents arrive to the cortex, but there is also another change which to understand we have to look inside the cortex, and is the fact that the cortex laminates. So this main layer of pyramidal cells that was present in the reptilian is split in two, and inside is inserted a layer of granule cells, essentially, of the layer 4 of sensory cortex. And it's the layer where the afferents from the thalamus, from these new thalamic projections that come from the core nuclei of the thalamus, terminate. So it's again the insertion of a front-end layer of granule cells, as in the hippocampus, in a different way, but again here you have a new layer of granule cells which is inserted before the processing done by the older kind of pyramidal cortical cells. We have to keep in mind that the fact that the inputs arrive to layer 4 does not mean that layer 4 cells are the only ones receiving the thalamic input. All cells whose dendrites are in layer 4 will receive the same thalamic input, as long as the input connections are not selective. But there is a kind of a preferential flow of information, that information arrives to pyramidal cells but also arrives to granule cells, and from granule cells is relayed to pyramidal cells, a bit as it happens in the hippocampus. So I took a picture, and I forgot whether this is, what species this is, maybe a hedgehog, I don't know. But I like this picture because it shows isocortical lamination in its bare essentials. Yesterday we had a nice talk by Bob, and we saw a bit of the complicated circuitry of the visual cortex of a primate, where there are all these layers and sublayers. And as a kind of sobering up, we need to look at the sensory cortex of a simpler mammals, in which essentially lamination means the insertion of these granule cell layers and the differentiation between superficial pyramidal cells, what we can call layer 3, and deep pyramidal cells, the layer 5, and the new granule cell layer in layer 4. Then there are, in the course of 200 million years of evolution, there are many complications to this basic scheme, and one such complication that is of course very important to us and generates maybe 90% of the neuroscience research on the structure of the cortex is the complication of the visual cortex of primates. But it's something that comes much later in evolution. The basic step at the transition from reptilian to mammals is the one described in this picture, where you have the insertion of a layer of granule cells.
I ask you a question about this picture.
Yes.
You say now.
I don't know which species is on, so I can give any answer.
Layer 4 granules are now excitatory interneurons. Were they not in the previous granulation?
In the hippocampus, yeah. In the hippocampus, there are also excitatory interneurons, yes. So in both cases, probably these two changes occur at the same time or around the same time. But so in both cases, you have cells that are excitatory but that project only locally, that are inserted at the front end of a circuitry of pyramidal cells. This feature is the same. The difference that you can appreciate immediately from the two pictures is that in the cortex, the granule cells are inserted in register with the pyramidal cells on a sheet which is isomorph to the sheet of pyramidal cells, whereas in the hippocampus is a separate structure. There is some correspondence along the rostrocaudal axis, but it's a separate structure, so there is no meaning to having a granule cell sitting exactly on top of a pyramidal cell. Here there is a meaning. Okay.
And another question I had about this story.
Yeah.
It's a nice story, but what at all links the granulation of the isocortex to what's going on in the hippocampus, except your intellectual analogy?
The rest of the talk, this was meant to be a kind of pedagogical introduction. The rest is my argument for what is the advantage of this granulation in the cortex. And you will not buy my story, but my story will make the point that that there is some analogy in the advantages brought about by the two granulation, but no, it's not the same thing. Okay, so let's...
Alessandro, yeah. The inhibitory neurons, they're not isolated anywhere.
The inhibitory interneurons there are different types of inhibitory interneurons in different layers. Yes, there is. Henry Markham is now the expert in the zoo of.
I have a stupid question. What does the term interneuron mean?
Just that a neuron that projects only locally, where locally means that not to other structures, not to distant portions of the cortex, or not to. Short range interneurons. Yeah.
So in the old days, granule cells were inhibitory?
No. Granule cells is, if you want, a kind of loose term. And in fact, I use it because it's a term that was used by the creator in giving the instruction. But in fact, in the sensory cortex, in many cases, layer 4 cells are just kind of smaller pyramidal cells. It's a...
Well, you keep emphasizing they're now excitatory, meaning... Go back one
slide. I want to emphasize that this is an excitatory interneurons, which in the cortex was an kind of unknown entity. You had the pyramidal cells and the inhibitory interneuron. In other...
So in early species, there were no excitatory neurons.
Yeah, essentially. With to the degree that these laws apply in biology, but in other structure, in the basal ganglia, you have the principal neurons are inhibitory, but in the cortex, the principal neurons were the pyramidal cells, and the local neurons, the interneurons, were inhibitory. And this is a new thing, is you have an interneuron which is excitatory. So, anatomists that have wondered about this puzzle of granulation have long kind of hypothesized that it's part of the same package, parcel, how do you say? The topography and lamination come hand in hand. And supporting kind of evidence or hints for that is that the systems that laminate are the topographic system. So essentially in mammals is visual, auditory, and somatosensory system. It's the systems where there is a direct correspondence between which portion of receptors are activated on the receptor surface and which portion of the cortical sheet is activated in the cortex. Whereas the olfactory system, for example, is the main example of the sensory system which is not topographic, in which there is no such relation, whatever Walter Freeman may say or others. Now, there was a paper recently on the maps in the olfactory bulb, but essentially the olfactory system is not topographic. There is no relation between which portion of your receptor sheet in the nose is activated and which portion of the piriform cortex is activated. And the olfactory system, even in the most advanced olfactory mammals like dogs, is non-laminated. Is a piriform cortex is a paleocortical form, which is essentially like reptilian cortex. It's very confusing for the naive reader like me to read papers about piriform cortex, because they talk about layers in piriform cortex, but the layers they mean is the main layer of pyramidal cells, and then the layer where the dendrites, the apical dendrites of the pyramidal cells are, and then there is a deep layer where there are essentially the basal dendrites of the pyramidal cells with some other mixture of sparser mixture of other cells. But essentially there is just one layer of cell bodies of pyramid. It's essentially like the reptile. So the olfactory system is non-laminated in the sense of the neocortex of mammals.
But is this difference related to the fact that it doesn't have a topographic mapping, or is it more likely to be associated with the fact that the piriform cortex doesn't receive thalamic innervation like all of the other neocortical areas? Maybe the lamination you see in the neocortex is more of a self-organizing feature that relates to the innervation from thalamus.
It's a very good point, and in this view, the three things come together. So the relay through the thalamus is also part of the fact that you have this topography in the sensory system. The inputs that come from the thalamus come with this. A kind of illuminating perspective is the one that has been emphasized recently by Ted Jones, where he talks of a gradual development of a new system of thalamic projections, the core nuclei, which supersede the older thalamic afferents from the matrix of the thalamus, which were poorly differentiated among sensory systems, whereas the new core nuclei, like the LGN for vision or the medium geniculate for audition, are strongly differentiated and project to layer 4. The older system projects diffusely to the superficial layers. So indeed, I mean, you could say maybe the olfactory system never had a chance to have projections to the thalamus and to induce lamination. Would be quite right, but I would also say that the olfactory system did not have a need for topography, because there is no meaning to where are odorants hitting your nose. There is nothing we can nothing useful we can reconstruct from knowing which receptors in the nose are activated. It does not relate to where the odorants come from in space, just because odorants fly. You know, so the olfactory system did not need, if you want, the neither the thalamic relay nor the topography in the cortex.
Is the insular cortex laminated?
Where the taste, I think I left it out because it's a kind of moot issue. Maybe you know more about this than I do. But there is some kind of loose topography in the tongue. So there is a prevalence of like bitter sensitive receptors towards the back of the tongue, the aftertaste, not the tail. But it's not clear whether this would be homologous to the loose topography of reptiles or to the fine topography of vision in mammals. Okay.
So how do the reptiles handle somatosensory?
So, to the extent that this thing has been probed physiologically, there is a kind of loose topography which is produced by these gradients, but it's nothing like the fine receptive fields of mammals. However, you have to keep in mind that the forebrain, where the thing we are talking about, has been invaded by this topographic system really in mammals. Earlier on, it was essentially an olfactory structure. And the systems that now are the superior colicos, inferior colicos, and so on, were the real sensory systems for these topographic modalities. And the superior colicos is topographic also in reptiles, so it allows frogs to snatch flies and so on. So we have to keep in mind we are talking about topography in the cortex or in the forebrain. Okay. So another further hint is the fact that in our cousins, the dolphin and whales that went back to the sea maybe some 50 million years ago, then lamination never completed really. So there is a kind of incomplete granulation in their cortex. The layer 4 is like underdeveloped. So it's consistent with the idea that lamination and topography come together, although it's vague evidence. So the hypothesis that I explore is that there is that this lamination is a solution. Yeah.
Since you have them there, even in the auditory sense, I mean, you must have
the
auditory sense.
So in the auditory sense, that topography means a relation essentially between one main variable, which is frequency of the sound, which is mapped nicely on the cochlea, and the position along one dimension of the auditory sensory cortex. There is a kind of long-standing puzzle whether the other dimension, the orthogonal dimension in the auditory cortex, represents something else that we don't fully understand, or it's really only one dimension that is really used. It's not clear, and if you ask auditory people, they have different ideas. So.
I don't see a reason why the auditory cortex of a whale should be less sophisticated than ours.
Okay, so the point you make, it's a good point, because this thing is not really telling us anything definite. It's just, also we don't know why should vision, even vision, why should vision in dolphins be less topographic. So it's not clear. The only point I raise is that maybe the environment, both visual, auditory, and somatosensory, the environment of a species that lives mainly deep underwater is so different that the computational demands it makes on the sensory system like take it in a different direction, and so this process of granulation has been kind of slowed down or halted midway. But it's not that I know what is the direction in which it takes. And maybe it's completely wrong reasoning. And I just quote it as an interesting fact that these species have, like, seem to have taken a different path at some point. Yes?
I'm sort of curious about just the computational argument, because dolphins are allegedly extremely intelligent. So lamination doesn't seem to be needed for complex abilities.
Right. I think it's a perfect point, and I would like you to come out of this talk convinced of that. So I would like to propose that this lamination is a computational solution to a very specific problem, which does not have to do with kind of generic intelligence or so on. But it's the problem that comes with fine topography, which is a problem of a piece of cortex having to relay two different types of information, which I call where and what. And before we get bogged down in this wording, let me show the model which clarifies for us what I mean with where and what. So this is the thing the whole work is about. It's a very crude and unrealistic model in which I have a piece of thalamus, an input station, and a piece of cortex, patch of cortex. And the cortex recedes from the thalamus and then has lots of these recurrent collaterals. And the crucial ingredient of the model is that I apply to the thalamus an input activity, which then I want the cortex to process and relay on. And this input activity is a convolution of two factors. There is a detailed pattern of activity, so each neuron in the thalamus is activated according to what its activity would be in one a pattern representing a possible stimulus. So think of that for intuition as the somatosensory system. And the detailed pattern would correspond to one type of stimulus applied to your skin. For example, whether it's a sustained pressure or some vibration of a punctuate transient stimulation of your skin. So that's one of several possible patterns. Each pattern corresponds to a different mixture of Pacini, Ruffini, corpuscles on your skin, and this would translate into a different mixture of cells in the thalamus being activated. And this is the pattern of activation. This is multiplied by a special focus, which tells you where the stimulation is applied. So it could be applied here, but also here or here. The same stimulation could be applied in different places. Then this would be distinguished by different spatial focus. Or a different stimulation could be applied in the same place, would be distinguished by the pattern of activity. Okay? So what...
No, you have an input, which is the detailed pattern. So what comes on top of that? What's the
spatial
focus?
The focus, I take it to be a Gaussian.
Is it a property of the detailed pattern? Or
no, it's something independent.
Like attention?
No, it's where I apply the detailed pattern. So say you think of the detailed pattern as Ruffini corpuscles being fully activated, Pacini half, and Wegener, whatever, there are lots of Germans.
It's local, the pattern is local.
The detailed pattern I define over the whole somatosensory cortex as a certain mixture of these different types of skin receptors. Okay? And then the input activity is the product of this general pattern multiplied by focus, which tells me where is the stimulus. So I activate Pacini corpuscles, but only at the point corresponding to the middle of my arm.
So yeah. I keep the detailed pattern fixed,
yeah,
and change the special focus.
Yes.
What will I get?
I will shift this Gaussian along this dimension, yeah, so that a neuron that is poorly activated in the detailed pattern is a bit enhanced if the Gaussian is centered on this neuron, and would go to zero if the Gaussian is shifted away. Whereas a neuron that is very strongly activated has some activation even if the Gaussian is not. No, it's not a shifted
so why
version.
Why you say the same pattern can be applied everywhere? It's a different pattern.
The input activity is the product of the same pattern by this Gaussian. Okay.
It's not that you take the same pattern and shift it.
No, it's not shifted.
So both of these things are spatial.
Both of these things are spatial, though this is spatial in an explicit sense, in the sense that it's defined by its center and it has a certain fixed width, whereas this is spatial in a implicit or complex sense, in the sense that at each point I have some unit that receives from a mixture of receptors and therefore is more or less activated by a pattern. But you can think of this as being non-spatial, as being just the identity of the unit. You could think of like this thing, these units here, being units like in the visual system that all belong to the same, have all the same receptive fields, but belong to different...
So it could be that it's not spatial, and that actually the envelope is just the envelope of the spatial activation, and then this is another dimension of quality.
Exactly. So it's one way of putting it, that you can think of this as non-spatial. You can, but if you were to like probe my system on the computer by going with the units at some position, you would see that this unit has some activity which depends on the input. So you can attach this activity to that place where you record from, but the relation with the position on the cortical on the thalamic sheet is complex, so you would not know how to interpret it. So one way of simplifying it is to say it's non-spatial, and I would agree with that interpretation. And this is the spatial part, is the easily decodable part. So it's important to understand better this thing, because this is all there is to this model. This distinction between variability on the spatial dimension, the where dimension, and variability in the identity of the pattern. Okay? It's two different things. Now, there is one more thing actually to the model. I apply this product of the two to the thalamus. Activity is propagated along this feed-forward connections to the cortex. There are lots of recurrent collaterals in the cortex. Then I read activity in the cortex, and I try to understand both. Where was the focus, and which pattern I used in the thalamus. Okay? But...
I understood what you did. Yeah. I don't think why you did it this way.
I do it in this way because I want to be able to measure, to quantify the performance of my patch of cortex at doing each of these things separately. So I want to be able to decode from the patch of cortex, from the activity of the patch of cortex, where is the focus and which is the pattern, independently of each other. So by doing it this way, instead of using like the shift, okay, I can simply do the kind of best match for where is the focus of activity and the best match for which is the pattern, and the two are orthogonal to each other.
Yeah, but it looks like the pattern is defined on a much bigger...
The pattern is defined everywhere.
The pattern is much bigger than what's actually applied.
Exactly. The pattern is everywhere.
So when you will say that you decode...
I can use only...
This pattern, the pattern, yeah. Only this pattern.
I can use only that window, the rest is essentially all at zero.
Yeah, so what's the importance of saying that there is just one pattern which is defined everywhere,
because then if I had applied this focus some other part of the thalamus, I would want to still decode that it was the same pattern.
So the ultimate goal is to decode the whole pattern and say that this is one pattern.
Yeah, independently of where is the focus. And at the same time, I want to decode the focus. I want to do both things.
Yeah. But so you might say, give them another pattern.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a certain number of patterns, like 10 or so.
So you say you scan it at different places, you want to decode what the underlying pattern was.
Let me see if I understand correctly. Yeah. So the pattern would be, let's say the whole body is compressed with the same pressure or something like that. But then the focus would tell me that actually it's not the whole body which is compressed, it's just this part.
Exactly.
Topical pressure.
Perfect. Yes. Yes. So, and what I want to do is decode which pattern it is. So it's overall pressure rather than overall vibration or shaking, say. But I don't want to reconstruct the full pattern, just to decode it, just to understand the identity.
You cannot do it based on just one. Form.
No,
you
have to. I can do based on. I would need to scan all of it to reconstruct it.
Yes.
But to just decode it to understand which one it is, I can. Yes. I can use just the one.
There is enough information.
Yeah. So I have the information just for one particular application, one focus. Then I do an average measure when I put the focus in all possible positions, but it's the measure of how much information I can extract just for one sensory experience.
This focus is coming from inside or outside? It's like applying pressure here or there, or it's like putting attention here?
It's from the outside.
From the outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you then have two detailed patterns which are different, but in the piece which you happen to focus on now are identical.
That yes, I could do that, and I would be giving the X on my feet, so I don't do that. I have patterns that are generated as random, and they're different everywhere, provided you have a large enough window to look at them.
Yeah, but if I think about it as some visual scene, and then the focus is just the gaze.
Yeah.
So
because of
also be a good example.
Yeah. So it would be pathological in the sense of this model. So think of the somatosensory system as a
I still understand.
Sure.
Suppose you had a red and a green stimulus.
Yeah.
That's one point visual space.
Yeah.
What would the response be in the LGM compared to just the red stimulus? Do you just write it down?
The visual system is not the most intuitive thing to look at this, but still with colors, it's fine. Okay, so the red and green channels from retina to LGN correspond to a different mixture of neurons activated in.
Okay, so you can see. Okay, so red and green, in a very simple case, you get two neurons in LGN.
Yeah.
So
one pattern is both neurons active, and the other pattern is one neuron active and the other not.
And they both go to the same space, but they don't.
But this red and green would be duplicated many times in different positions.
Yeah. Okay.
So the color is about the only thing that you can think about in the visual system that is simple enough to fit into this scheme. Okay, so the other ingredient of the model is that I use these input patterns to teach, to train the system, modifying feed forward, but mainly the recurrent connections with the Hebbian associative scheme. But then when I test the system, I apply a detailed pattern, which is only a cue, which is a fraction of the pattern I use for training, and the rest I leave my cortex to make sense of it. So the cortex sees a thalamic activity which corresponds to the spatial focus, as it should, multiplied by a noisy version of the detailed pattern. A fraction of the units are activated as they would be in one of the patterns used for training, and the rest is just random activation. And I hypothesize that the crucial function of the cortex that makes it an interesting system, like I think Eric told us last week, is that it is able to use memory of previous experiences, what I use for training, to reconstruct the identity of patterns that are presented in a noisy version in the thalamus. So the cortex does not simply relay what is in the thalamus. In the sense of spatial focus, yes, it's purely a relay, but in the sense of the identity of the pattern, it reconstructs the full identity from a partial cue using recurrent collateral activity.
Is this just
associative memory? Yeah. Okay. So then in the simple diagram I had done just one layer of cortical cells, but in my model really I have three layers that are in register one of the other. And what I do is a comparison between a uniform model in which the three layers are identical in a statistical sense, all the connections on are randomly generated, so they're not fully identical, but they have the same properties, same connectivity and properties. And then a model of the isocortex in which there is a differentiation between the layer of granule cells and the layer of pyramidal cells. So I do a comparison between these two models. These don't read, but just to say that one can measure the information about position, the where information, and the information about identity, the what information, just as one would measure an information quantity from the activity of the units. I do that by looking at the activity of the units in the cortex. I can do it looking at the activity of all the units, or the activity of only the units in one layer, or even half of the units in one layer. And Klaus can tell you that if I'm in the saturated regime where I look at enough units that I have all the information that I can read from that population of cells, then it doesn't matter if I look just at a large enough subset. So in my uniform model where I have three populations that are identical, I can look at any subsample of sufficient size of those three populations, it would be the same information. Now, there are many parameters in this model, like any ugly connectionist models, but the crucial one that I want you to focus on is the spread of this feed-forward afference from the thalamus to the cortex. So I look at a regime, which I think is the meaningful one, in which I apply a spatial focus which is relatively narrow. I have recurrent connections in the cortex that are widespread. And then I look at the behavior of the model as I vary the feed-forward connections from being narrow, like the focus of activation in the thalamus, to being widespread, like the recurrent collaterals in the cortex. And it's intuitive that the where information, the positional information, will be more precise if the feed-forward connections are more narrowly pointed. It will suffer if they are spread, so it goes like the inverse or the log of the inverse. Whereas the identity information is also in kind of intuitive if you think about it. If I have, it has the opposite behavior, because if I have the feed-forward projections very narrow, I will not activate enough collaterals to use the collaterals to retrieve. So it's a less direct effect, but it's also understandable that I want to activate a lot of collaterals to retrieve memory from these collaterals and to bring out the identity information.
This is something. Focus always at the same location.
Well, in the simulations, of course, I put the focus everywhere and I do average measures. But
okay.
Each measure is for one application of the.
This computation is not separate for each focus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is focus? It's going to be on the log or just linear function.
This is not very. It's only the monotony of the trend. Don't think too much about the log. It's misleading. These are the results of the simulation. You cannot work it out analytically. Maybe you can, but I can't. So I have to do simulations. So this is the result of the simulations for what information in this uniform model, in which I have three layers that are identical. This is before any learning on the recurrent collaterals. The what information as a function of this spread of feed-forward connection is low in any case. As I train these recurrent collateral connections, it grows, and asymptotically, after three learning epochs, it is a monotonically increasing function of the spread, as we expected. So, to use these recurrent collaterals, the feed-forward connections have to be widespread, and it kind of doubles the information that I can extract about the identity of the pattern.
What was the seeding? How many of the?
This is a result in the next graph I'll show different numbers, but it's the same behavior everywhere.
And this again,
so the ceiling would be at 2.
This is a particular focus.
And this is with a particular Q. Particular, what did you say?
Just one.
Yeah, this result is averaging over all focus, but it's a measure for one. And it's also for a particular size of the Q, which is 0.4. So 40% of the units are activated as in the pattern, and the other 60% I have to imagine.
And you train one network and then change the spreads?
No,
you train them with different spreads and compare.
Yeah.
So these are different networks.
Yeah. The where information is like this.
From four patterns, you distinguish only two, like there's only one bit.
Yeah, essentially. It depends on the size of the queue. I'll show you later how it depends on that. But, yeah.
Why can't you principle?
You
can sort of identify.
You can, only that you need a larger queue. Because, as you say, I use only one application for each time. So the where information is non-monotonic with learning. This is before learning, and the asymptotic is the red one. But essentially, in both cases, it decreases with the spread of connections, as we could understand intuitively. So I want to combine these two graphs.
Okay, and why does learning make it worse?
Well, it makes it worse when the feed-forward connections are narrow, because learning effectually means to spread them out a little bit, not by changing the connection, but by changing the weights. It's a kind of, you can convince.
What is the learning?
The learning is the an associative plasticity.
You are not learning to.
No. Exactly. Now, this is a kind of side effect on where information of just purely unsupervised associative learning. I combine these two graphs into a graph like this. Confusingly, I put just look at one of these four boundaries. This is the graph.
So when you learn, you don't pay attention to where.
Exactly.
But now you somehow include it into your.
I don't pay attention to where. I don't even pay attention to what, because it's unsupervised learning. It's not trying to optimize a what cost function. It's just associative learning. So here, just look at one of these, like the upper one is for 12 patterns. I plot them as where information against what information. And different points correspond to different spread of these feed-forward connections. So when they're very widespread, I have a lot of where information, but little what information. When they're narrow, when they're spread out, the opposite. But what I can see from this graph is that there is a kind of boundary. I would like to optimize both quantities to go beyond this boundary, but I am limited by, there is a conflict, there is a compromise I have to do between war and wet where and what, no wars. So this is the boundary that applies to a uniform model, and you can see that, you know, I can vary many parameters. This is vary the number of patterns, these different lines. If I vary other parameters, I have other lines, but I always have this kind of compromise I have to do. So the idea is that differentiating a granular layer, just differentiating, so not adding units, not adding synapses, but differentiating some of the units I already have, may help me go beyond this boundary. And ideally, I would like to have a granular layer that works by focusing the activation on the cortical sheath without disrupting the action of these recurrent collaterals. First, we'll do it, and then we'll see how to understand it. So the model is exactly the same model as before, only that now I have different properties for these units here, okay, that we'll detail later. And the result is that it does work in the sense that I can produce points or networks that are a bit beyond this boundary that apply to the uniform model. Here, these different points are different choices of, I now have even more parameters because I've differentiated these properties, I have other parameters. So I just had the choice of three different choices for each case of parameters that bring me beyond the boundary. Of course, I can choose many parameters that bring me below the boundary. So these are good cases. Yeah.
So you got the boundary. But it looks like the fundamental limitation is still there. Even if you can shift the curve a little bit more, it doesn't really mean that you have a fundamental improvement, right?
Perfect. That's exactly the kind of main point I want to make, that a qualitative change in the circuitry brings just a small quantitative advantage in information, in this information I can relay and reconstruct. And I think this is what, I'm sure you will not buy my story, but this is what the ultimate message of the story is, that one has to understand a qualitative change in terms of a small net advantage. It's not a new function that my cortical sheet does that could not do before, it just does it a little bit better. And to measure this little bit, you have to do these kind of long simulations that each point here takes like 4 days on a PC to run. So it's a long effort to just measure a small advantage. Yes?
And you can do it a lot better. I mean, if you, as long as you have two layers, you have different divergence to each layer, right? Is that inconsistent with anatomy?
So that's a... One of the modifications that I make is that the granular layer receives focused afferents, whereas the pyramidal layers receive widespread afferents.
So literally the layers don't talk to each other, they should be fully independent, right?
If the layers don't talk to each other, that's an important point. If the layers don't talk to each other, I can kind of optimize each layer independently. However, here I require something more stringent. I require that these two types of information, I should read them from the same layer, from the projection
layer. So you can't extract the two layers independently, combine them a third, in a clever way so that you don't lose anything?
You are too clever. So you are more clever than Adam and Eve. You are clever as monkeys that developed a separate what and where stream, which is a more advanced solution to the same problem. So I think here we have to focus on, or to think of, a primitive mammal in which there is just one sensory area, or the rudiments of one sensory area per sensory modality. And when mammals then develop so many sensory areas, they find it advantageous to separate out what and where streams. Yeah, but I think it's an answer, a next answer to the same problem.
Okay, so I have one more question.
Yeah.
Suppose you had a pattern that was changing very rapidly in space.
Yeah.
Right? In that case, you'd sort of, I mean, divergence would not help you identify it. Divergence would average it, is that correct?
It's, I think we can get bogged down in thinking about Fourier patterns in this model. So think of the somatosensory system, then we can take it up for discussion how it would match an extended visual pattern. Yep.
Could you be a little more specific about what you did, going from the previous slide to this one in terms of trying to break the boundaries?
I will.
I'm not so clear about, for instance, what the two different parameter layers, how they differ and how they are related, and also where the readout is, all this stuff.
Perfect. It's in the next slide. So just to fill in the little bits, this is the dependence on the Q, something that it's an important point, although it's orthogonal, is that if I put a larger Q, I can decode better the identity of the pattern. This is before learning and this is after learning. So just look at the red line. It's a very non-linear function of the fraction of the Q activated. If I'm here, 80% Q, I can decode. This is with, I think, 12 patterns, so I can decode essentially precisely the identity. If I'm at 0.4, I have a little bit. And the wear information also benefits from having a fuller Q, but less so. The important point is that the improvement due to the lamination is there whatever is the size of the Q. So here I have different Q sizes, and there is always the boundary and the three dots that correspond to the parameter that bring me a little beyond the boundary. This is in a, where information is in a linear scale. The what information here is linear, so you can see well the upper regime, whereas this is with a log scale, so you can see that even for very small cues where I can retrieve very little of the identity information, still the granulation buys me an advantage, which is that the dots are always beyond the boundary. So now to your question, what in detail do I do to this layer for a differentiated model? So this is the boundary that applies to the uniform model. You can think of starting from the situation where the feed-forward afferents are widespread. So I'm here, lots of what information and little where information. And then I apply a number of modifications that have to be applied all together. So first, I restrict the collaterals of the model layer 4 units. If I do that, the what information decreases abruptly because I use less less efficiently the collateral. Here I'm looking at information that I can read off the layer 2-3 units, the superficial layers, not directly the layer 4 units. But still, the information I can read from the superficial layer suffers if I restrict the collaterals of layer 4. And I have no improvement in wear information. So it's a net loss. Then I do another modification. I focus the afferents to layer 4, okay? If I focus the afferent to layer 4, if I do it on its own, I have...
The above it was still, the afferents going everywhere.
Yes, okay. I want to separate out the modifications to do it step by step. If I do this thing alone, I have little change in the information I can decode from the superficial layer. But if I do on top of modification number one, I have this change where I now increased a lot the wear information. It's, you can understand it. If you restrict the collaterals of layer 4, but still layer 4 receives from widespread afferents, I don't gain anything in wear. If I do both together, I gain in wear. I don't lose anything more on what, but I'm still beyond the boundary. So I need the third modification. This was the thing that kept me bogged down for a long time, that I needed to change something else. And this this other change, which I found works, and I hope it relates a bit to the physiology that is known, is that I modify the dynamics of the layer 4 units so that it's essentially more sustained than the dynamics of the pyramidal units. In the simulations, I model it in a very crude way, but the idea is that it could reproduce one of two different phenomena. One is that granule cells might adapt less in their firing than pyramidal cells because of a different mixture of channels. And the other thing is that there might be differences in the short-term synaptic properties, so that effectively their influence on other cells is less depressing with sustained firing than for pyramidal cells. Both of these are very big question marks. I don't know really whether they match the reality that is found, but I just give it to you as what I needed to do in my model is modify the dynamics of the granule layers, so that effectively it's more sustained.
So the step response is more sustained.
It's the response to a step activation is sustained, whereas that of pyramidal cells adapts. Yeah. So if I do it on its own, it doesn't change a thing. If I do it just coupled with the first modification, it brings a bit more watt, but not much change. If I do it only coupled with the second, also it doesn't change much. And only when I do the three of them together, I go to this point beyond the boundary. So the argument is that I need all three modifications together to produce this point, which is beyond the boundary of the uniform model. This is the combination of information that I can read from the superficial layer. If I were to look at the granule layer really starts from here, because now it receives focused afferents. So the uniform model that corresponds to the new granular layer would be the model here with the focused afferents. If I do these modifications, I get here, which is from the layer 4, I can read a bit more wear information, a bit less watt information, but essentially it's close to the point where I was before, but with the focused afferents. Yes.
Then we have to compare, but what's the role of this impact in the lower limits?
Exactly what comes next. So this let's skip. So the granular layer indeed helps focusing the activation in the map without interfering with the retrieval of the identity. The mechanism that I would like you to understand, even if you don't buy the story, is that I need this sustained dynamics. And the thing is that there is an interference between the process of specifying exactly the focus and retrieving the pattern with the recurrent collaterals. And I avoid or I diminish this interference by decoupling the two processes in time. So by having the layer 4 sustain its dynamics, essentially what I do is I allow the pyramidal layers that receive the inputs directly from the thalamus to initiate the retrieval of the identity, so to go to the right basin of attraction in the attractor language. And only later, once they're already kind of rolling down the slope of the correct basin of attraction, which they don't reach every time, but if a fraction of the times they reach the correct basin of attraction. Later, then the layer 4 units exert their maximum influence and tilt the table, as it were, so as to position the focus of activation as in register as possible with the focus of activation in the thalamus. So the two processes are partially decoupled in time. It's a very imperfect decoupling because it's just produced by having this slightly more sustained dynamics. But this is the kind of crucial ingredient in avoiding this or lessening the conflict, is to to use time, the time dimension, to decouple the rolling in the right basin of attraction from focusing it on the right spot. It's two orthogonal dimensions, because the basin of attraction is in an abstract space of the pattern that does not correspond to anything, whereas the focus of activation is in the very physical space of the cortical sheet. So these two rolling downs are in these two different spaces, and they interfere with each other, like one is Brownian motion with respect to the other. But if I decouple them in time, they they can do a bit better than occurring at the same time.
So which layer receives direct lady information?
All layers. From all three layers receive from the thalamus. Uh-huh. By virtue of dendrites in layer 4. Yeah. Now, to your question, what do infragranular layers do? So one clue comes from this pattern of connectivity which is in the basic mammalian plan of the cortex, whereby the supragranular layers project onward, essentially. They relay the output of cortical processing to the next stage. Even in the reptile, there is a distinction between the feed-forward projections that go from the lateral cortex, the olfactory cortex, through the dorsal cortex to the medial cortex, which is like the hippocampus, is like the output of the cortex. And the infragranular layers project essentially backward or downward to non-cortical structures. If you take two areas in the monkeys, like two extra striate visual areas, and you want to understand which comes first in the flow of information, it's an ill-defined concept, but you want to be as specific as possible which comes first, then you look at the pattern of connections. If the connections from one to the other, like there are many papers on that, if the connections from one to the other are from the superficial layers to layer 4, and from the other to the first, are from the deep layers to the superficial layer, then the first comes before the other one. So it's in the basic mammalian plane, there is this difference in connectivity that gives different roles, or looks like it gives different roles to the two layers. So if this is the case, then it's obvious that all the arguments have been talking about so far apply really to the supragranular layers. They have to project onward, so they have to relay the Beck's mixture of what information, which is the result of their processing, and where information, which they have to relay from the thalamus, but they need to be known onward. Whereas the infragranular layers, if they mainly project backward, they should project the result of the cortical computation, the what information. But there is no meaning to projecting backward the where information, which is already known backward in the thalamus, is already known more precisely than in the cortex, where the stimulus is. So I do another modification then to my model. Modification out to this model layer 5. Essentially, I take out layer 5 receives directly from the thalamus. In the previous laminated model, the granulated model, it receives also from layer the superficial layers, from the granular layer, and from itself. Now I remove the connections from layer 4 to 5 and substitute them with new connections from superficial to deep. So I just change, it's a radical change, and I'm sure it does not correspond to the cortical connectivity, but in the model that's how it's done. Instead of 4 to 5, I have 3 to 5, an equal number of 3 to 5 connections. Yeah, sure. The full diagram is a bit complicated. So I just draw the connections to the layer 5 units. Okay? They come...
Which?
5, 3, 4. Okay? So the connections to layer 5 come from the... say, from the afferents, okay? They come from other layer 5 units, okay? They come from layer 3. In the old model, they came from layer 4 as well. Now I cross this out and I replace it with another connection from layer 3. Okay? So I have an equal number of connections, but I have removed the 4 to 5 connections. The effect of that is that the activity I read of layer 5, which before was exactly the same statistically as layer 3, has moved to a new point in my what-where space, where I have lost a lot of where information, gaining a little bit of where, of what information. So in my thinking, I have optimized the what information without caring about the where.
This again, looking at the afterthought, all these dots are from layer 3?
From layer 5. Whereas from layer 3, I've moved a little bit in this direction. So before this differentiation, 5 and 3 were the same point. After this fourth manipulation, I've differentiated 5 and 3. Both have lost a bit of wear because essentially I've decreased the influence of layer 4 over layer 5. This indirectly reflects also on layer 3. But the indirect effect is weaker than the direct effect. So both move in this direction, but layer 5 by much more, and layer 3 by less, and layer 4 also in the same direction by much more, so by much less. So let me show.
You can still say you have what and where.
Yeah. So exactly. So this is the summary. Again, confusing is two different lines. Just look at one. So there is the old boundary, and then I have three points which are all beyond the boundary a little bit. The point which is really attempting to do the best compromise is the supragranular layer, what I can read off the supragranular layer. The layer 4 has emphasized the where without caring about the what, and this is information that is read by nobody else, just by the other two layers, because it's an intrinsic projection. Whereas layer 5, which is supposed to project mainly backward, has emphasized the what at the expense of the where. Now, one other question, and this is what I was doing these days. This is relates to your point. This is a very small advantage, and it's obtained with simulations on a very small network. All you have seen so far was 20 by 20 patch of cortex, and here I try to see how it scales with the size of the network, and I attempt to do a meaningful scaling where I scale up the size of the network, I scale the number of patterns that I use, and I scale the spread of these connections and the number of connections per unit, all in a certain relationship to each other, so in a way that I think can go up to large numbers. But in practice, I can examine very small numbers. So this is the 20 by 20 that I used originally. This is 15 by 15 with 7 patterns. This is 20 by 20 with 12 patterns. And this is 24 by 24 with 18 patterns. So in a certain scaling relationship to each other. In all cases, I have a boundary and the points that are a bit beyond the boundary for the three layers. Okay? So this is the data you have seen before. I've added here the error bars on a single measure. So these amounts of information, just for I try with many different networks, but when I do it with one network, I have this error bar. So it's one measure for a given network. It's not one measure for a given application of the input. So the size of the errors, more or less, is the same in absolute term as I scale up the network. But the information, of course, goes up, both where and what. And the degree of advantage, the size of the advantage, is more or less constant in relative terms. It slightly increases, but is more or less constant in relative terms. So in terms of a percent advantage in information, it is constant. So since the error is more or less constant in absolute terms, and the advantage is more or less constant in relative terms, here the advantage is clearer with 24 units. Here I would have not believed this graph here, because it's all within the error of a single measure. You can see that these lines are also kind of crooked when I have a small network, and they tend to become smoother when I have a larger network. So I have no idea how it really scales up, and it would be interesting to be able to do some more analytical work, but there is an indication that the kind of the percent information gain is more or less constant or slightly increasing, so it gives good hope that for a more realistically sized network it would. So this is 24 by 24 units in each of the layers and in the thalamus.
And a small one?
15 by 15.
So it's not a big
range. It's not a big range, no. In terms of patterns, it's 7, 12, and 18. I can see that if I put, like in this 12 by 12, if I put 20 by 20, if I put less than 12 patterns, I'm down with the what information at this level. But if I put more, I'm not up to this level because I hit the storage capacity of my recurrent system. So I cannot put very many patterns into the network I have.
So once you made a number of patterns really large, and you could be looking at saturation again.
Exactly what I was saying now. If you
made a number of patterns huge and just increased network size, then what would happen?
What I told you, that if I in the 20 by 20 I tried putting more patterns and I hit the storage capacity, so my what information goes down. You see, so I need, if I want to see the effect scaling up, I have to increase also the size of the network, not just the pattern.
With more patterns, your information drops. That's a function of the network artifact, right?
It's much more complicated than when you think about the storage capacity. You think of an ideal situation when the basin of attraction just vanishes. But here I am using a queue, so it's a complicated thing. But yes.
You basically ruin the whole network.
What?
If you try to structure many patterns, you basically ruin the whole network.
Yeah. What I see is that this line. Does not scale as it does when I scale up the network. Now this whole account is essentially independent of dynamics, except for this thing of modeling differently the dynamics of layer 4. And now this is just a small point that there is a student that is looking at a kind of more sophisticated aspect of the differentiation between supra and infragranular layers, that once you add another ingredient, which is a spike timing dependent plasticity rule, you can use the deep layers for something more sophisticated, which is a prediction in the sense of a time prediction of what have been regularly occurring streams of sensory data. That's something else that is doing in applying it to a model for learning grammars. And there is a parallel possible with the difference between CA3 and CA1. In a sense, CA1 is like the deep layer of CA3, but I don't want to expand on that. So to sum up, the real functional hypothesis is the core of this thing, of this hypothesis about lamination, is that the original role of the cortex is to analyze sensory data using simple attractor dynamics based on associative plasticity, which is self-organizing weight changes. And this attractor dynamics is, in this hypothesis, is all really there is to the dynamics of pyramidal layers. But there is this new ingredient which is brought by lamination, which is the new granular layer that keeps in register, in positional register, the activity of the pyramidal cells. Just to acknowledge, there was a student from Australia that with whom we did the first part of this work, that is looking at this conflict between what and where. And in fact, he developed a completely independent model, which is different in everything, but there is still this same conflict, this same boundary that you cannot go beyond in the what-where space. And then he kind of got carried away with that, and he thought he could prove mathematically that this is a boundary that applies to any model, independent of the network. It's a coding theorem that he had. So he gives lectures saying that the reptilian cortex is just as good as the mammalian cortex, but I don't believe him.
What about mathematical proof?
Well, you know, these mathematicians. So, the two implications that I want to draw at the more general level. One is that we all would like to understand qualitative changes in the structure with qualitative changes in the function. Even I would like to do that. But it may be that in some cases it's not possible. And it's conceivable that something that, like lamination, that occurs at a certain a crucial point in time with the emergence of mammals, that occurs in all sensory system, and which is difficult to see it as associated with a specific change like in ecological behavior or in the niche in which mammals sit. It could be something that has to be understood at a more quantitative level, as a quantitative change. And at a more quantitative and at a more abstract level, not as a, you know, something that is brought about by the fact that early mammals, I don't know, foraged over a wider space or something like that, but something that has to do with very abstract and generic quantities, like how much information of a certain nature their nervous system can process. So I think, you know, in thinking about evolution is always very loose, and it's very difficult to make arguments precise. But clearly, the reasoning is much more appealing and precise when you can point to a fact that did not exist before, and with this new fact you can associate a new structure, a new organ, a new something. Here, instead, I think it requires a kind of finer thinking, where a new fact is not explained by a new structure is not explained by a new fact, but is possibly explained by a small quantitative advantage in doing the same thing that the forebrain was doing before. So I claim to be sorry for this, but in fact I think it's a good opportunity for quantitative modelers like us to have something to say about the evolution of brains. Just the very last point is that the original instruction was granulate and multiply, and in the hippocampus we failed to multiply, but in fact in the cortex in advanced mammalian species there is this impressive multiplication of areas that all use the same basic circuitry, the same basic laminated patch of cortex, but there is this thing that new and new areas are added in each sensory system. And this, I think, is another global trend that has to be understood in terms of an abstract computational advantage. And there is another student that maybe if she continues her PhD, she's working on a model that tries to understand this generic trend that area multiplication, arealization, as Leah Krubitzer calls it. That's it. Thank you.